This is an incredible honor to both be able to be up here to introduce you, Sister Allen. I interviewed you in the year 2000, and I interviewed you in the year 2002, and my life was changed both times. I covered an execution here in Oregon in 1996. It was the first execution we held in Oregon in over 34 years. My intent in covering that execution was to tell you a story of what happens when we kill people in this state, to get you to feel it, to get you to question it, to get you to wonder what is it like for the people who have to do the job, for the victims who wait sometimes decades for this, for the condemned to walk those final steps. But what I found as a reporter is that I was impotent to tell that story. I didn't have that story the night of the execution to tell you. All I had was props, what things looked like, what they sounded like, what words were scripted to give us. And I promised myself one day I would tell that fuller story. I didn't know how. Then in 2000, I met Sister Helen, and I had lots of questions for her. I'd read her book, I'd seen her movie, but I was in no way prepared for the questions she put into my mind that reverberated with me. I was 3 months away from having my little boy, Elijah, my only child, and I was just filled with this woman's ideas and her stories. For those of you who've seen Dead Man Walking or read the book, you know that Sister Helen was asked to be a pen pal of one man, Patrick Saunier. And so she accepted being a pen pal of this man who was condemned and living on death row in Angola and Louisiana. And she became his spiritual advisor, and she became his friend, and she became the face of love that he looked at the night that he was strapped to a chair and a hood was put on his face and he was executed. She became that face. And in that moment, she told me in the year 2000, she underwent a second baptism, a knowledge that her life was changed and she had a new mission in life. And that mission was to put a face to people like Patrick Saunier, so that people could know that they are not solely the worst thing they've done in life. They are a human being beyond that. She wanted to put a face to the system of justice that could kill people. She wanted to change our justice system in the United States and globally where executions occur. And since 1984, when you walked out of that prison in Angola, 10 years later, Dead Man Walking came out. 2 years after that, the movie came out. Now there's an opera. Now there's a play. She inspired me to write The Crying Tree. She inspires people around the world to examine their souls when it comes to who we are and what is this word called justice. Sister Helen Prejean, I am honored to be able to be up here and say hello and welcome you. Thank you.
We in the United States are one of the few nations of the world that still practice the death penalty. And I get asked the question all the time, especially in Europe, what is it about the American people that makes you cling to vengeance and killing as a way to try to answer your problems? What is it about the American people that you do that? And I always say to them, it's not that the American people are wedded to this. It's just that most people don't think about it. We're separated from it. There are 32 human beings sitting on death row in Oregon. You haven't killed anybody in 26 years. What is Oregon still doing with the death penalty on the books here? Why haven't you gotten rid of it? What holds it in place? Why is it that anybody, almost every politician that runs for office, and especially those who run for national office or Congress, feel they have to get up before the people and say, I'm tough on crime, I'm for the death penalty? By now, they must know all the things wrong. By now, they must know that 139 wrongfully convicted people have been let off a death row, saved by college volunteers in innocence projects. By now, they must know that the thing isn't working. By now, they must know that the criteria that the Supreme Court gave for when you select death is that it's only for the worst of the worst murders. Who knows what worst of the worst murders means? If my mother's killed and that personal universe is lost of my mother, that is the worst of the worst. If my child is killed, if a policeman is killed, if a fireman is killed, if a public health nurse is killed, if a teacher is killed, if a child is killed, if a teenager is killed, if any human being is killed, that is the worst of the worst. Because we have been made unique and irreplaceable, and the loss of any of us is the worst of the worst. But in our hubris and in our thinking that we can lay out guidelines and ways of doing this, that we are going to have the wisdom to be able to select that. And we're going to turn it over to juries. And we're going to let DAs be the discretionary ones to decide whether or not they go for the death penalty or not, or whether or not the case will simply be plea bargained in the back room of either a police station or a court. You admit your guilt. We don't go to trial. You get so much for your sentence. And the lawyer and the DA negotiate with one another. Well, we can get a manslaughter. We can do this. It's negotiation. It's bargaining. 98% of the criminal justice cases are settled through plea bargaining. And we have all these high ideals. We have the Constitution. We have the constitutional protection every lone individual brought up against the power of the state is supposed to have. A jury of your peers, it's fair and impartial. Due process of the law, equal protection under the law. An attorney by your side who's supposed to be able to present your side and access your constitutional rights. That's the theory. And justice has always been a theory until we live it out. We are not just physical components that go around these little automatons that just work through chemistry, electricity, eat food, drink, Starbucks, whatever, listen to music. We are spiritual beings in our core. We want to know truth, and we want to know love, and we know and we're outraged when human beings are killed. And that's the fire we got to deal with in our own heart. Because when innocent people have been murdered, when they have been ripped out of life, and we know about it, there is a part in us that is outraged over that. And I want to say that that outrage we feel is ethical. It's ethical to be outraged when human life has been violated and life has been taken. The spiritual question for us is, what do we do with the outrage? And if we don't plumb our own hearts, and if we don't descend into the fire of that part of us that says and feels, well, whoever did that deserves to die, if we don't go there and it's unthought, then when somebody, some politician runs for office and says, ladies and gentlemen, we got to be tough on crime. Anybody does a crime like this, that's why we need the death penalty. And so your legislators, as in most states, with the exception of 12 in the beginning, and now with the exception of New Jersey and New Mexico, who within the last 2 years have done away with the death penalty. And when they did, they lit as a symbol of that end of government killing the Roman Colosseum. That's the oldest symbol of state killing in the world, the Colosseum in Rome, where people were taken and were killed. And to honor New Jersey and to honor New Mexico, the Colosseum was lit. What happened in New Jersey and New Mexico that the people and the organizers could finally get to those legislators to say, don't kill for us? The death penalty is 98% about politics. And I'm not saying this cynically. I mean, this is actually what is going on. It's a political symbol. And when, in the way our campaigns go, when people are afraid to pick up an issue that's controversial, they all want to be on the side of just showing how tough they are on crime. We have been governing by crime for the last 25 years in this country. Tough on crime, law and order. I'm really tough on crime. You want to know how I'm really tough on crime? I'm for the death penalty. And he's not, or she's not. And what does it really mean? And why do I say it's 98% political? Because when you break it open and you look at it, and that's the journey we each have to make. What does it really mean? Outrage over the crime, yeah. But finally, it is about us. It is about us. And so what we have been about in the last 30 years since the Supreme Court said it's not against the Constitution of the United States to take human beings and strap them down, render them defenseless, and kill them for their crimes, since our Supreme Court put it into motion in 1976, when only 4 years earlier in the Furman decision of 1972, they had looked at the application of the death penalty around the country and said it's arbitrarily and capriciously applied. And it's disproportionately levied on the poor and on minorities. They had just done that in 74. And then in 76, they said, okay, we're going to set new guidelines that it's not going to be arbitrary and capricious anymore, and it's not going to be disproportionately levied against poor people and against minorities. They set new guidelines. Part of it is it's supposed to be only the worst of the worst. And we're going to have two trials, one for guilt to innocence, and then we're going to have a sentencing trial. And there are going to be guidelines given to the jury so that then they're not going to be in a disparate way just deciding all over the place, and it was like being hit by lightning. And the problem I was pointing to earlier about worst of the worst, picture this. There's a terrible crime and people are outraged. Let's just say the person's guilty. It's just slam bam. You can see there's the DNA, there are the eyewitnesses, there's everything. We know he's guilty. And then we turn it over to a jury who are citizens just like us, ordinary people, teachers and people going to school and people with jobs and people with families. And these 12 people are given a special mission. We have found the person guilty, but now you have been chosen to decide if the person lives or dies. It used to be that jurors, when they're trying to decide life or death, would send a note to the judge and ask, what sentence will the person get if we don't give the death penalty? Because they have a heavy responsibility to protect society from a person who's done a very violent and heinous deed. And they wouldn't answer them. So they go back in and they say, well, we got to give the death penalty because maybe the person will get out. Maybe they'll do 10 years. Maybe they'll do 15 years, but they'll get out and they'll kill again. We got to protect the people, and they'd vote for death. Now, jurors have to be told, if you do not give a death sentence, it means the person in Oregon is going to get life without parole. They will be in prison the rest of their life. The people can be safe without having to kill. They are told that. And when they go back, and in my book, The Death of Innocence, I tell the story about jurors. Do we ever think of jurors? And because if they don't have a unanimous decision for death, if there's even one of them that says, let the person live, the person lives. So each juror, in effect, holds the person's life in their hands. The responsibility is in their hands for whether or not that person lives or dies. For a long time when I was writing the second book, I called the working title I had for it was Impossible Burden. Here I am, a juror. It's been an unspeakably terrible crime. Here, this mother's children were killed. And then when you come to the second trial, the sentencing part, and you can bring in people to testify, talking to jurors about, give life, don't give death. Here's why you have to give death. Here's where you have the prosecuting attorney saying to the juror, look at that family. Look at this suffering family sitting here in this courtroom. And they are never going to see their child graduate. They are never going to see their grandchildren. Do justice for this family. They have sustained the ultimate loss in a murder, and so they require the ultimate penalty, death, which is justice. Give them justice. And what justice means is give the death penalty. And that will honor the one who has been killed, and that will honor and heal this victim's family. And the jurors look over at the family who are sitting there. They've had to sit through the whole trial without showing excessive emotion, or there'll be a mistrial. They've been schooled by the DA in that. Do not show undue emotion, or they can call a mistrial. And here you are, called as a citizen to do justice, and you look at them in their sorrow, and you think, I haven't had a loved one killed. How great must be their pain. Ultimate crime calls for ultimate punishment. But then there's also a part of your heart, because during the sentencing part, when people could come and speak for the defendant sitting there, one of the people who got up was his mother. And she says to us, the jurors, I know my son did a terrible thing, but he's my son. And he's had a hard life. His father and I separated. We lived in poverty. He slipped out of my hands. I know I didn't do a good job with my boy, but don't put him to death because of me. Let my boy live. Don't kill my son. And you remember the story of Solomon, the wisdom of Solomon, of trying to decide two mothers who claim the same child. What are ordinary folks like us, human beings with frailties and partially seeing and making mistakes, how in the world can we ever handle a decision like that, that I will choose between these two mothers and decide if somebody lives or dies? It is beyond us to do. And we should not ask that of each other. And do we ever think of the guards who have to carry out the killing for us behind prison walls in a secret ritual that you are never going to see? Tim Robbins has trusted the play of Dead Man Walking over to the young people of this country for 10 years in the Dead Man Walking School Theater Project, doing the play of Dead Man Walking to bring in live drama, to bring us as close as we can get to this, so we can break out of this little intellectual thing, oh yeah, they kill, they deserve to die, end of discussion. So that we can get a hold of this thing at a deep spiritual level, and not just at a surface level, they kill, they die, end of thinking, end of feeling. In order to have the death penalty in a society, we have to turn a switch inside ourselves, that those people on death row, and extend that over to the enemies in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and the terrorists. Those people are not human the way we are, and the only way we can continue to be safe and survive as a nation is if we kill them. The making of enemies, which must be destroyed for us to be able to carry on with our lives. And we are separated from them. We do not see them in the eyes. We do not hear their stories. We do not meet their families. And most of the time, and here's what I learned about victims' families, when I went to the victim family support groups, everybody in the group said, everybody stays away from us. Nobody knows what to do with us. One man who had lost his daughter said, sister, you want to see a room empty out? Just let me walk in it. Victims' families need our love and our support and our accompaniment. They need us around them when their marriages break up. They need us around them when they lose their job. Their children, their siblings of those who have been killed need us, because the family's been fractured, it is broken. I talked to one young woman whose sister had been killed, and she said, my life's over. I mean, my parents, all they can remember is the anniversary of her death. They remember her birthday. They go to all these, you know, meetings and everything. And I've been lost by the wayside. They lost me in this. They don't have love for me. They are so caught up in this thing of my sister dying, and I've been lost in my family. Those of us who are called to reconciliation, not to choose in polarities, this side or that side, but to hold up for the dignity of all life and to embrace and accompany the victims' families in their suffering. And on the other hand, the dignity even of those among us who have done a terrible crime. I've been in there personally to look into the eyes of people who have done these crimes and to accompany them. And I'm going to tell you, the very first visit to the very first man on death row, Patrick Saunier, when the guards locked me in a room and said, we'll go get your man, and they went to get him, and I had only written him letters, I'm going to tell you, I was nervous about meeting him because I didn't know what it would be like for 2 hours to talk to a human being who had murdered another human being. Like, would his eyes look different? Would there be like this set to his jaw? Would we be able to have like a normal conversation? Or is he filled with violence, filled with blood, filled with this sickness that... And when the guards brought him in and I looked at his face through the heavy mesh screen that separated us, I could not believe how human his face was. We have images of people as the worst of the worst, as the enemies of the people, as the people we have to kill. But to meet them personally, talk to them, anybody who's ever been to death row will tell you they're human beings. They are human beings. And all of us are worth more than the worst act of our lives. That is not our essence. We are not our acts. We can do terrible acts, but we are not that act. We are more than that act. There's a transcendence in each of us, and that's dignity. And in the dialogue with my Catholic Church, with the Holy Father, with Pope John Paul, I said, Your Holiness, does the Catholic Church only uphold innocent life, the dignity of innocent life? What about the guilty? And when I'm walking with a man to execution, and he says to me, Sister, please pray that God holds up my legs as I make this walk. And he's been rendered defenseless. He's shackled hand and foot, surrounded by guards, and he's going to be taken from this room here and walked down this aisle here and brought out that door and strapped and killed. There is no dignity in this death. Can we be for the dignity even of the guilty, or is it only for innocent life? That's the journey. And it's more of a struggle for us because we have that feeling in our heart of ambivalence about this. And what is the sign that the spirit of peace is in us? We connect and build community rather than separate. We know that we cannot take anyone and rip them out of the fabric of the community and take them out and kill them. When we do the work we are called to do, and when we stretch past boundaries of what we have done up to a certain point, when we feel ourselves be called to go beyond what we've done, to participate actively in the movement in Oregon to end this thing, to end this government killing, then we feel peace. But the Spirit also nudges us. There are images in Scripture of stirring those waters up, of getting that flame going, that we are talking about something vibrant and something living, and not a little lullaby Holy Ghost song like sometimes religious songs can be more like lullabies lulling us than waking us up and connecting us in community. If we have never signed a petition, If we have never stood in vigil to protest the killing that is done in our name, as the poet Rilke said, more is required than being swept along. And the Hebrew prophets teach us. Isaiah teaches us. Amos teaches us. Jeremiah teaches us. Stand up. Stand up and move. Stand up to change things and not to be complicit in it. If we're silent, we've never acted to resist it. We are complicit in the gurney that sits there in Oregon waiting to kill people, and for all the 32 human beings that are being warehoused up on that row waiting to be killed. We are part of it because we're a democracy. We're citizens. It's up to us. And spirit is about waking up. Spirit is about feeling the fire in us. Who, me? I'm shy. How can I do that? I can't get up and speak in front of a bunch of people. We can stand up in community. All of us, Oregonians for alternatives to the death penalty, stand up and begin to act. And if you have never put your precious signature as part of the movement to change the death penalty, I invite you to do that momentous act today. You also need to feed your fire. How do we feed the fire in us for human rights and for justice? We read. We meet people. We go to meetings. I have to tell you, these days at the University of Oregon have been wonderful days. I have been with young people. I'm telling you, I am really filled with hope from what I have encountered there. Young people who want to work for peace and conflict resolution other than violence. The quality of the discussions with young people about how the death penalty works. What are our alternatives? What about restorative justice in our society to heal rather than to imitate the killing? It takes just one person to initiate something. And then when we have a spark and we have a fire, and then the fire begins. We're here today to build a fire. A fire that is going to transform us. And recognize the dove, the spirit of peace that is in our hearts when we have been stirred to action, and then we begin to act. Acting is not as hard as we think. The powerlessness is when we think about things and then we don't act. The minute you put your hand on this life rope and begin to pull, life flows through us and we feel peace. Because we are acting in authenticity and integrity and in community to transform our society. And we are made for nothing less than that. So if you're not there yet, then you got to read, or you got to stoke the fire, you got to talk to somebody, because we're long past the time where we can just say, I don't know what I think about that, and then we're complicit in what our state is doing. So thank you. Thanks for all who worked on the ground to prepare this event today. And I'm glad to be a part of it. Thank you.